Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Alexander DeSanctis of National Review is in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, bad, and crazy martinis, plus a very special champagne toast at the end of today's Three Martini Lunch. All of it today brought to you by Casper Mattresses. Right now, get $50 off towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/lunch and using the promo code lunch at checkout. Much more on Casper a little bit later in the podcast. And Alexandra, one of the things we have heard in recent weeks is that not only is President Trump not bothered by the Russian attempts to meddle in the 2016 elections, he's not even concerned about Russian meddling in future elections. That was a big highlighted news item either last week or the week before when all the intelligence chiefs were there testifying before the Senate, and Jack Reed of Rhode Island specifically asked the FBI director if, in fact, President Trump had given specific directives to ward off Russian attempts to meddle in 2018 midterms. Christopher Wray said, well, we're well on the way to doing that, and we've got a lot of plans in place to make sure it doesn't happen. And Jack Reed says, no. Did President Trump specifically tell you that you needed to do that? And he said, well, maybe not specifically, but, you know, it is our job. So Homeland Security Secretary Kristen Nielsen has now been more specific on what's going on here. She said on Tuesday that she touted the department's efforts to engage with state and local officials on guarding U.S. voting infrastructure from cyber threats, stressing that public trust in vote counts relies on secure election infrastructure. Nielsen issued the statement highlighting the Department of Homeland Security's recent meetings with state and local election officials, which included classified briefings from U.S. intelligence officials on cyber threats to U.S. voting infrastructure. Quote, the American public's confidence that their vote counts and is counted correctly relies on secure election infrastructure. The first primaries of the 2018 midterm election cycle are just around the corner, and DHS and our federal, state, and local partners have been working together for more than a year to bolster the cybersecurity of the nation's election infrastructure. Once again, Alexandra points out that just because people aren't talking about things publicly doesn't mean they're not happening. And obviously, it's good news that the government seems to be taking this threat seriously, and preserving the integrity of the vote's always a good thing.
Yeah, of course. And I think this is really, you're getting to the heart of the problem here with this type of initiative, because, you know, there's a lot of talk about whether Russia was taking out Facebook ads or if there were Russian, you know, Twitter bots influencing the election. Those things obviously aren't good either. But this is much more serious because it's looking at votes and were votes counted properly. And, you know, I don't think there's really any indication that Russia was able to hack voting machines. But as Nielsen said, voters' confidence has to be in the fact that their vote's going to be counted the way that they vote. And that's, I think that's the biggest issue we have to focus on in terms of eliminating actual Russian involvement in our elections.
What do you think about changing the way we do the votes? I know a lot of the places now have the optical scanner where you actually do fill out a paper ballot rather than just punch a button on an electronic voting machine. And that way you at least have a paper record of it. Some people want to go all the way back to pencils and paper ballots. What do you think is the best way to make sure that cyber mischief doesn't happen at all?
I personally prefer the old-fashioned paper ballot method. It just seems much more secure. I guess if Russia wants to hack, they're going to hack, but it's a lot easier to do if you have a really complicated technical system, I would think.
The midterms are going to be fascinating for a whole number of reasons. Let's hope one of them is not because of any problems from foreign mischief or even domestic mischief. But Alexandra, let's move on to our bad martini now and move on to the gun debate. It's interesting that all of these networks have reporters aboard the bus of these students headed to Tallahassee to make their demands for gun control for Governor Scott and the Republican-led legislature there. I'm sure, Alexandra, you would agree that if these students wanted teachers to be able to be armed or armed security in the schools, that all the networks would also have reporters on the bus and chronicling every step of this journey too, right?
Of course. You know, it's all about the fact that they're students and they have opinions no matter what they are. If they're pro Second Amendment, we'll respect them as well, right?
Yeah. No, not really. That's not the way it works. But it's been interesting. Jim and I have documented in a number of different ways here how really we focused on how CNN has kind of really gone off the rails in terms of objectivity. No big surprise, but basically suggesting that the NRA and teeing up these kids to call them child murderers and so forth. Let's go over to MSNBC, though. We need to share the wealth here a little bit here. And who loves to share the wealth more than MSNBC? Katie Turr, no stranger to biased journalism, was anchoring her slot on MSNBC, just transitioning between stories. And, you know, if you're not really closely paying attention, you might not even catch this. But she wants to make sure that you catch it either directly or subliminally. Here's what she said.
And coming up, kids or guns? What do you value more? Students from South Florida head north to confront Governor Rick Scott. We're on the bus with them.
What do you value more, kids or guns? And obviously, you would probably answer that you value kids more. So therefore, Alexandra, the only right response if you value kids more than guns is to go after the guns, because that's the only thing that's ultimately going to stop this, which is the talking point we hear over and over again. What do you make of this blatant false choice here?
Oh, it is so intellectually dishonest. First of all, I mean, it just doesn't, it's a false construct. It's a straw man. It doesn't make any sense. But on top of that, coming from somebody who I know and from a network that often, you know, pushes people supporting unlimited abortion rights, it's incredibly difficult for me to take them seriously because, yeah, of course I value kids more than guns, but you don't need to, you know, value guns more than kids to support the Second Amendment. And I'm not going to take you seriously if you simultaneously support abortion.
60 million now in the past 45 years since Roe v. Wade was decided by the Supreme Court. And so that point has been pointed out that you've made, that obviously they're okay with 60 million abortions, but they're absolutely making people decide between kids and guns now. Do you think they even sense that there might be a bit of hypocrisy there, or are they so disengaged from the unborn being human beings that they don't even see it?
I think that's exactly right, because you don't see, you know, I mean, we don't have pictures of the unborn on the cover of newspapers because their schools aren't getting shot up. They're being killed very silently and stealthily. It's not something we like to talk about, and people don't even think of the unborn as human, although, you know, more and more science and technology are allowing people to look at it that way. And I think that's why people are becoming more pro-life. But for a party that supports abortion, denying the humanity of the unborn is a lot easier than trying to deny the humanity of these school children, which, by the way, nobody on the right or left is trying to do.
Do you think this strategy is going to work by basically saying if you're serious about loving kids and protecting kids, then you're finally going to do something and restrict gun rights in some way? Do you think it's actually going to work?
You know, I'm not sure if it's going to work in terms of they'll get an assault weapons ban passed or something like that. I kind of doubt it, because those types of bills are so unpopular and really aren't targeted at solving the problem here. But I do think this kind of rhetoric is very common, even among, you know, just your average everyday American. Nobody likes to see schools shot up. Nobody likes to see kids suffering. And so I think people are susceptible to this kind of argument.
In terms of the people that are strongly pro-Second Amendment, do you think this argument's likely to work on them, or is it going to motivate them in the opposite direction of, how dare you accuse me of wanting to murder kids just because I'm exercising my constitutional rights?
Right. I think very much the latter, because the vast majority of people who own guns, even AR-15s, do so for self-defense. They're not out there shooting kids in schools. And the suggestion that to own a gun makes you somebody who's okay with kids being shot by, you know, a lunatic is just totally intellectually dishonest, unfair, and really offensive.
It's a debate worth having just on the merits back and forth. Obviously, people have got free speech rights, and if you want to engage on a public policy issue, that's fine. We've had this debate before, and there's obviously strong arguments in both directions in terms of the passion. Obviously, we would probably agree that the constitutional argument is stronger on the pro-Second Amendment side. In terms of positing this as a choice between kids and guns is, as you said, intellectually dishonest and honestly quite disgusting. And we would encourage the liberals to approach this a little bit more with intellectual honesty and, quite frankly, to give it a rest. And so, as long as we're talking about rest, we need a lot of that these days. And Casper Mattresses is the place you want to turn to. Casper is a sleep brand that makes expertly designed products to help you get your best rest one night at a time. The experts at Casper work tirelessly to make a quality sleep surface that cradles your natural geometry. Did you know you had natural geometry? You do. In all the right places. After all, you spend one-third of your life sleeping, so you should be comfortable.
The original Casper mattress combines multiple supportive memory foams for a quality sleep surface with the right amounts of both sink and bounce. Its breathable design helps you sleep cool and regulates your body temperature throughout the night. Casper now offers two other mattresses, the Wave and the Essential. The Wave features a patent-pending premium support system that mirrors the natural shape of your body. The Essential has a streamlined design at a price that won't keep you up at night.
All Casper products are designed, developed, and assembled in the United States. Prices are affordable because Casper, they cut out the middleman and sell directly to you. Every Casper mattress is delivered right to your door in a small, how-do-they-do-that sized box. I've seen the boxes. It really is amazing. Plus, there's free shipping and hassle-free returns in the U.S. and Canada. Still not sold? You can be sure of your purchase with Casper's 100-night risk-free sleep-on-it trial. So, here's a special offer to listeners of the 3 Martini Lunch. Get $50 off towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/lunch and using the promo code LUNCH at checkout. That's casper.com/lunch and use the promo code LUNCH for $50 off select mattresses. Terms and conditions apply. Alexandra, one of the stories that broke over the last couple of months of last year, and I guess he officially resigned in early January, was the story of Al Franken ultimately losing his Senate seat, forced from office over multiple allegations of improper groping. The biggest one, of course, being the one that was accompanied by the photo of him either mocking a grope or actually groping of Leanne Tweeden on a USO flight. But now Newsweek magazine, in a story that is being roundly criticized, has suggested that it wasn't Al Franken's behavior that got him kicked out of office. It was really internet bots. Quote, a pair of Japanese-based websites created the day before Tweeden came forward, and a swarm of related Twitter bots made the Tweeden story go viral and then weaponized a liberal writer's criticism of Franken. The bot army, in tandem with prominent real live members of the far right who have Twitter followers in the millions, such as Mike Cernovich, spewed thousands of posts helping the hashtag FrankenFondles and the Franken is a groper meme effectively silenced the testimonies of eight former female staffers who defended the Minnesota Democrat before he resigned last year. On December 7th, the day after the Democrats started calling for Franken to step down, the freshly minted Japanese-based fake sites went to work and republished an article by a liberal writer urging women and activists to stop supporting Franken. So the bots made everyone do it here, Alexandra. Al Franken and the multiple allegations, those are just mere details, apparently, in this story. And apparently, although it's mentioned, I thought bots only fooled Trump voters. Apparently, they also fooled Kirsten Gillibrand and about 30-some members of the U.S. Senate into convincing Al Franken it was time to hang it up. What do you make of this?
I think what we're missing here is the fact that the bots wouldn't have had much to work with if Franken hadn't committed all these actual sexual misconducts, right? If they had just been created, they weren't manufacturing these charges. These women were real women with real stories, one of which, as you said, was accompanied by a picture. So perhaps these bots, you know, there doesn't seem to be much evidence, but perhaps these bots were part of stirring up the outrage about these incidents. But these incidents did, for all we can, you know, from the evidence we have, did take place. And the fact that Senate Democrats weren't upset about it until there was social media outrage, I think, is a much bigger problem.
Basically, the Senate Democratic plan backfired. There's no actual proof of this, but I think it's pretty clear that they were assuming Roy Moore was going to win in Alabama, and that's why they kind of threw Al Franken up there and asking him to resign to be ideologically consistent when Senator-elect Roy Moore showed up. Well, guess what? Roy Moore didn't win the race, and then they were stuck with demanding Al Franken resign. Am I in a conspiracy theory there, or do you think that was pretty much how it went?
No, I think you're right. I actually did a story around that time. I tried to get in touch with every single Democratic senator and ask them if they would vote not to seat Roy Moore if he were to win the election. And all of them, except for one, I believe it was Ron Wyden from Oregon, they all either didn't answer or, you know, gave some sort of form answer, didn't say that they wouldn't vote to seat him. And I think, you know, I kind of suspect it's because they like to have him there as a punching bag and they like to be able to, you know, protect their own guy by pointing to the Republicans and saying, look, they're worse, which really is not, you know, for all their talk about a war on women and standing up for women's rights, they really aren't so good when push comes to shove.
Here's the other thing on this, Alexandra. You know, you spend time on social media. I spend time on social media. And everybody's claiming that, oh, these bots and all these Russian internet people change people's minds with all these memes and hashtags that they threw up, like Hillary for prison 2016 and so forth. In all your time online, have you ever changed your opinion because of a Twitter or Facebook post with a hashtag?
No, I don't think so. If I have, it's been, you know, the rare thoughtful exchange that takes place. And those have never involved a bot or a hashtag. So,
which I think goes to a deeper point, which is that from the left's perspective, You couldn't possibly actually have this opinion. You must have been deceived somehow into not doing what we think you should have done, whether it's vote for Hillary or support whatever issue that is on the plate for that day. But just an honest intellectual conclusion that's opposite from us in numbers sufficient enough for you to win is not feasible.
It's just odd that in this case, the preferred position happens to be that maybe Al Franken wasn't so bad after all. That's what I'm stuck on.
I guess so. Oh, man. Well, let's move on to our champagne toast here. Alexander, I think by now most folks know that the famed evangelist Billy Graham has died. He was 99 years old. Had he made it to November, he would have been 100 years old, active in ministry for, I believe, over 60 years. And just so many things to appreciate about Billy Graham. And I'll tick off three here real quick, and I'm sure you have thoughts as well. Number one, just the fact that he preached a very clear gospel, which was his main calling. God loves us. We're all sinners. Jesus paid the price for that sin on the cross. And by trusting and following him, you can be saved. The fact that he went for 60 years without a scandal, and he put parameters in place to make sure that there were no scandals, moral, financial, or otherwise. And he's being largely remembered today as kind of the pastor to the presidents. And he obviously met with every one of them, I think, since Harry Truman. It was reported today he gave the invocation at 9 inaugurations. But at the same time, and I think this is an interesting contrast to some folks in the evangelical world today, Billy Graham never forgot what his first mission was, and that was to preach the gospel. He did get involved in politics, but there was never any question about where his heart really was and what he was most passionate about. And nowadays, sometimes you have to wonder about that. So the loss of Billy Graham is great. Condolences to his family, obviously, but I don't feel sorry for Billy Graham right now, because Billy Graham is a really happy man right now.
I'm sure he is, and I think I'm a little too young to fully appreciate everything that he's done. And also, as a Catholic, I probably don't fully appreciate the effect that he's had. But even this morning, you know, my editor was saying his dad, who wasn't a particularly religious man or anything, went to a Billy Graham event just because it was Billy Graham. I think this was the kind of effect that he had on people. And another person in the office was saying how his grandfather was converted precisely because he went to a Billy Graham event. You know, wasn't particularly religious at the time, ended up becoming a Lutheran minister, still preaches today. And so I think it's really easy to see how the effect that he had, just sort of, you know, that ripple effect, that butterfly effect, has ended up touching probably thousands of people's lives for the better.
Very well said, Alexandra. Good to have you with us. As always, we look forward to the next time.
Absolutely. Thanks, Greg.
Alexandra DeSanctis of National Review in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Hey, don't forget to visit Casper Mattresses, casper.com/lunch, and get $50 off towards select mattresses. Terms and conditions do apply. casper.com/lunch. And tune in on Thursday. David French will be here for the next 3 Martini Lunch.